We will now look at the section labeled Three Canonical Penalties and Theologians. We're going to now look at the developing consensus among Christian theologians, particularly beginning in the 4th century, in regard to how the particular issues of abortion and of contraception, and in the case of Augustine, suicide, should be evaluated in the Christian theological and moral traditions. The Christianization of the Roman Empire in the 4th century meant that the role of bishops became progressively more important. Bishops would in many cases become magistrates, that is, they would be given responsibility not only for the local churches, but also for the administration of local law, to some extent, in their communities. And therefore, the church's approach internally to questions of discipline and of penance would be eventually applied in the developing corpus of canon and of civil law as well. So what we're going to look at in Basil's canonical legislation would, on the one hand, influence the developing sacrament of penance and reconciliation, and on the other, come to be influential in the developing corpus of Roman jurisprudence, Roman law as well. What we have in Basil's letter is an attempt to codify, to bring together and to standardize the approach that should be taken by bishops in regard to particular sins that are committed by their people. The sacrament of penance and reconciliation as we know it today did not exist in the early church. In the 4th century, and this had been the case since the end of the 1st century, the only form of penance was imposed by the bishop. The bishop, when he became aware of particular sins within the community, and these would especially be the sins of murder, adultery, or apostasy, would impose a penance usually consisting of excommunication for a period of time. Excommunication meaning that the individual would not be able to receive the sacrament of the Eucharist, and as the tradition developed, the individual would also not be able to join the worshiping community formally in the main body of the church. Sometimes they would be restricted to the narthex, to the entrance of the church, and in other cases even to the entrance outside the church. And they would be required to attend services but not participate fully in worship, and this experience of excommunication, of not being able to join the community fully in its experience of the Eucharistic liturgy, would last for however long the bishop imposed the penalty. Basil sought to coordinate and normalize, or that is to say, create a pattern that could be used elsewhere as well. So he published these letters that represented his own practice and the practice of the other bishops in his region of Cappadocia, and they became tremendously influential. They were recorded, they were reissued, and they still influence the approach that is taken in the Eastern churches to the particular sins that are described by St. Basil. And the penalty of excommunication, that is to say the imposition of a penance consisting of abstaining from the Eucharist for a period of law of time, sometimes extending up to several years, can still be invoked in certain parts of the Christian church, particularly in the Christian East today, using the example and looking to the texts of St. Basil that we'll be looking at right now. In the West, of course, but also in the East, there would eventually evolve not just the penalty of excommunication by the bishop, but the possibility of confessing sins to a presbyter, that is to say to a priest and not just to the bishop, and the priest would be able to offer absolution in exchange for the performance of a particular penance. And the penance would be guided by various collections of these canonical penalties, and then the later penitentials, that is, volumes that recommended particular penances to priests, which we will come across in subsequent lectures. But again, the importance of this particular set of canonical legislation cannot be overemphasized. It's very, very important and is still significant today. Now, one of the things to note, if we drop down to section 3.1, Basil's letter number 188, He refers to the canonical penalties, and he speaks specifically in number 2 of a woman who purposely destroys her unborn child is guilty of murder. So there is an equivalent of abortion and murder. And he says there is no nice inquiry as to whether the developing child is formed or unformed. So Basil rejects the tradition, the Jewish tradition, of distinguishing between an early and a late abortion as having a different canonical significance, as there being a greater or lesser degree of sinfulness. Now, as we'll see, particularly in the West, this will be reevaluated and the opposite will be decided. It will be decided that, yes, indeed, abortion is always sinful, but that it is more sinful after a particular period of time that is associated with the notion of the developing child being properly formed or ensouled, depending upon the particular approach of the theologian. Now, that is not the case with Basil. Basil, and indeed most of the Eastern Church, simply says very specifically, abortion is murder, period. Now, it is the equivalent of homicide, but he says, in fact, it's more complicated than that, if you drop down to the next statement, because, in fact, the woman is also harming herself. In most cases, women who attempt abortions die. And this is true given the nature of the very violent drugs that were used. He's also speaking about the kind of surreptitious pharmacological preparations that might have been available, not through people who had any kind of medical training, but through people who thought they would be helpful. And these could be terribly destructive drugs. And of course, as we've seen before, if some other method of abortion, particularly some kind of surgical abortion, were attempted, the threat to the mother would be very, very great. The risk of infection would be very high. So what Basil is pointing out here is that in the situation of abortion, it is not only a question of the woman being guilty of homicide in regard to her own child, but she's actually guilty of harming herself. It's almost a kind of an attempted suicide. He adds, the destruction of the embryo is an additional crime, a kind of a second murder. But note how compassionate this approach is. The punishment of these women should not be for life. That is, it should not be a lifetime excommunication, which could well be the penalty for intentional homicide, but rather, he says, for the term of 10 years, which is a long time. And let the treatment depend not on mere lapse of time, but on the character of their repentance. So Basil is encouraging leniency. He's recognizing that this particular crime, although substantively, morally constituting murder, has mitigating circumstances. Many later moralists will be more explicit. The woman feels afraid. She doesn't know what to do. In some senses, she may not be in her right mind. She may be abandoned. She may be under family pressure. And so it should not be treated as an ordinary homicide. Certainly, it is the destruction of the life of a human being. But in terms of the moral culpability of the person who engages in this act, as he says, it should depend upon the character of their repentance, the tropo tes metanoias of the individual who has engaged in this. Now, he adds in the section that's marked number 8 here, the next sentence down, women also who administer drugs to cause abortion, as well as those who take poisons, are murderesses. So it's not just the woman who's destroying her own child, but whoever gives her these medications, whoever provides her with the means of doing this, is also guilty of the crime of homicide. And the Church has maintained this tradition of not only the person who effectively performs the abortion, but also the person who procures it, the person who has made the arrangements for it and seen to it that this is possible. So the Church is not just penalizing the woman, but also recognizing that there is a network of people encouraging this act or making this act possible, and those individuals are also responsible. Also in the late 4th century, if you drop down to number 3.2, Jerome, in his letter, and Jerome is a very prickly and very kind of angry individual in many ways, Jerome makes it very clear And we'll see that he's certainly not the only individual who has this approach, that it's not only abortion that should be censured. Now, Jerome is not a bishop, and he's not in a position to impose penances or recommend lengths of excommunication, but he offers his opinion that abortion and contraception are both significant crimes. He says in number 13 of his text that I've provided here, his 22nd letter, you see many women who are widows before they are wedded, trying to conceal their miserable fall by a lying garb, unless they're betrayed by their swelling wombs or by the crying of infants. They walk abroad with tripping feet and heads on air. Some go so far, he's describing all the terrible things that he has seen about women who have engaged in various inappropriate sexual activities and become pregnant outside of wedlock. He says, some go so far as to take potions that they may ensure barrenness. So he is speaking specifically to medications that are contraceptive, and he says they thus murder human beings almost before their conception. So in Jerome's mind, contraception constitutes a kind of homicide as well. And others, he says, some when they find themselves with a child use drugs to procure abortion, and he says, as often happens, they die with their offspring, and he talks about how condemned they are. So this is one strongly held and, in fact, widely disseminated point of view, that both the act of abortion and the taking of contraceptives is a very, very serious sin. You find a similar approach. Jerome is writing in Latin primarily for the Western Church. You find a similar approach in number 3.3 in John Chrysostom, who at the end of the 4th century, at roughly the same time as Jerome is writing, a little before, John Chrysostom is the Archbishop of Constantinople until his exile, and he similarly is strongly condemning of both contraception and abortion. He says, many women, and he describes this as a characteristic of covetousness, and that is to say, people who do not want to have children because this would impede their life goals. He says, many at least with this view have paid money to be childless, and he says, have thus maimed their nature. So he regards this act as something that is actually violating the nature of what it means to be a human person, not only by slaying their children after birth, the idea of the problem of exposure of infants, but by not allowing them to be born at all. So strong opposition to the practice of contraception as well as to abortion. And now we drop down in number 4 to some texts by St. Augustine. And this is important for us in the Catholic tradition because Augustine's writings become profoundly influential. In many ways, Augustine is the first really bright, shining star in the Western theological tradition. Augustine writes in Latin. He even know Greek very well, and he's the first one to be able to do theology extremely well and to do it primarily or exclusively in the Latin language. So his text will be read. He himself becomes a very important father of the Western Church, although I must add parenthetically, Augustine is not regarded as a father of the Church in the Eastern, that is to say, the Orthodox Church traditions. And many Eastern theologians are deeply suspicious of Augustine. You may find this on Orthodox websites where the writings of St. Augustine often carry warning labels for people who read them. So it's important to realize that for us who revere Augustine, this is an aspect of the Roman Catholic and indeed also of the Protestant churches, but it is not necessarily shared by the Eastern churches. Augustine's texts cover a wide range of subjects, and we're going to move through them rather quickly. But the first issue that we haven't looked at in detail yet, which he does speak to, if briefly, is the question of suicide. We've seen that the Hippocratic Oath, and especially the Christian version of this, particularly condemns the practice of any kind of assisted suicide on the part of medical professionals. But the issue of suicide is very complicated, as I've mentioned in this text, under the gray bar that says suicide in the Greco-Roman world, because, of course, suicide, particularly in the context of the military, has a very ancient tradition and indeed continues to be practiced even today. One finds in popular literature and elsewhere the idea of people in the military having suicide capsules in case they are captured by the enemy. This is regarded as an acceptable alternative. Well, it was regarded as acceptable in the ancient world as well, not only in the military, but also there was a kind of political suicide in which an individual who was condemned by the emperor would be offered the option of committing suicide or of going through the formal rigors of a trial and condemnation and the public execution, which would result in the scandal to their family, but also often the loss of their property and the reduction of their family to poverty. So an individual could commit a kind of political or ritual suicide and spare the family this disgrace. So that was a not infrequent part of life in the Roman Empire, at least among higher Roman officials. And as we've mentioned before, if you were a physician in the household of such a householder who received a note from Caesar that, quote, his services were no longer required by the empire, and this was a clear indication that the individual should end their life now, the physician in the household would be expected to facilitate this as easily as possible. So there was a real conflict in regard to how suicide was viewed in the in Greco-Roman culture and how it would be viewed in by Christians. The other issue, of course, in regard to assisted suicide is the question of someone who has reached the end of life or extreme old age and has decided that they do not wish to continue living or they're suffering from a painful illness. What do they do in that context? And in the Roman Empire, suicide would have been regarded as a quasi-legitimate alternative. Now, I say quasi-legitimate because in many parts of the Roman Empire, suicide was technically illegal, especially in Greece, and of course it was regarded as a crime in Judaism. It's forbidden in the Talmud, but the effects of suicide are generally restricted to the rituals associated with that individual's funeral. It doesn't necessarily affect the inheritance of the family afterwards, and so it's a very complex issue. Now, Christianity would absolutely refuse to condone suicide, even in the context where culturally it might be considered permissible. And the most complex, of course, would be the issue of a military suicide. Christians would eventually come to condemn suicide absolutely, without qualification. In the later tradition, it would be regarded as a violation of the trust that one has been given by God over one's own body, and a recognition that only God has the right to take one's life. So one of the first theologians, at least in the Western tradition, and really one of the first Christian theologians to speculate on this question, is St. Augustine. And if you drop down to number 4.1, Augustine says in regard to suicide, he says, well, you know, there are people who say that suicides have a greatness of soul, that they've done this for very noble reasons, but he says they cannot be applauded for the soundness of their judgment. You can scarcely call it greatness of soul which prompts a man to kill himself rather than bear up against some hardships of fortune. Is it not rather proof of a feeble mind to be unable to bear either the pains of bodily servitude or the foolish opinion of the common people, of the vulgar? And this is from the City of God. So he's reflecting in a kind of an aside in the City of God on the question of suicide and saying, well, as Christians, we can't approve of this. It means that you're not willing to endure the suffering that God may have permitted to exist in your life. And He also hints at this idea of the possibility of it representing a feeble mind, which will ultimately be the rationalization, both in Judaism and in Christianity, that the suicide is probably insane. The person who commits suicide is probably not in their right mind, and so they aren't really morally guilty of having made a free and open choice. So that issue is already hinted at in this text from St. Augustine. If we could drop down, the remainder of the text have to do with his speculation on issues considering the beginning of life. Like John Chrysostom and like Jerome, Augustine is opposed both to abortion and to contraception. Sometimes he says a lustful cruelty or a cruel lust results in extravagant methods, and this is number 4.2, to use poisonous drugs to secure barrenness. And he's quite right. The attempt to do this would often be through the use of a poison that would have terrible effects on the mother. Or they destroy the conceived seed by some means previous to birth. Or if it was advancing to life within the womb, they regard it as better that it should be slain. So he is opposed and specifically condemns both the practices of contraception and of abortion. If we drop on number 4.3, here he's beginning, like Tertullian centuries before, to speculate on the question of when the soul is infused and what can we say about the fact that some children are born with such terrible birth defects that they appear really not to be human, or those whose lives are lost in a spontaneous abortion, are these individuals truly human? Do they have a soul? Will they be raised in the life to come? And Augustine, in number 4.3, clearly says, yes, God will supply to them whatever was lacking. This becomes an issue that we will look at later in the course in regard to the question of very, very severe birth defects and even certain circumstances in which what is produced as a result of conception turns out to be a tumor, but nothing that could be described as a human being fully. What is the theological significance of that? And in some ways, Augustine is speculating on these questions already in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. And number 4.4, he says, I do not know when the fetus begins to be alive. And he doesn't see any clear theological or medical answer to this question. I don't know whether it's possible to resolve it. At what time the infant begins to live in the womb? Whether life exists in a latent form before it manifests itself in the motions of the living being. That is, the sensation that a woman will have of a child within her. The child begins to kick. The traditional word for this is quickening, a sense of movement of the child within. And he says it seems too audacious to deny that the young who are cut out limb from limb from the womb, lest if they were left there, the mother should die too. To say that they were not alive seems too audacious. So, like Tertullian, he's lamenting the fact, without attempting to make a definitive statement about the specific morality of this, you know, terrible alternative. Do you allow the mother to die, or do you take the life of the child? He says, we cannot rationalize to ourselves that these children were not alive. They were alive. They were not breathing air, but they were nevertheless living. But he says, I cannot discover on what principle these individuals could be said to be denied an interest in the resurrection of the dead. So he's concluding, yes, indeed, we must presume that the individual is alive. I can't work out exactly when the individual begins to be alive. As we'll see in the later medieval tradition, especially in the West, as a result of Thomas Aquinas' appropriation of Aristotle's opinion, there will be speculation that there is a greater degree of humanness after the 40th day in the case of a male embryo, but we'll get to that a little later on. Let's look now at number 4.5. Here, too, he is reflecting on something which has significance in the modern day. What about terrible birth defects again that result in the production of an infant that is not even clearly recognizable as human. Does one necessarily presume that these individuals are somehow not going to be raised in a glorified body at the end of time? And Augustine says, no, we have to trust and have faith that God will supply whatever is lacking. The final section from Augustine with which we are concerned here, number 4.6, comes from his commentary on Exodus. And remember that he is commenting here on the passage we've already looked at, Exodus 21, which in the Septuagint, which although Augustine probably didn't read Greek particularly well, that's certainly what he said about himself, this is a tradition with which he would have been familiar. And remember that in that Septuagint translation, there is a distinction between the moral significance of a miscarriage that is induced through an act of violence towards a pregnant woman earlier and later in pregnancy. And the conclusion of that passage of Exodus 21 is that later in pregnancy, it is equivalent to homicide. This is something that Augustine is reflecting on, but it's important for us to be aware that although there are modern authors who attempt to use this passage as an implication that the early Christian tradition permitted abortion at an early stage of gestation, that is not correct. It was always regarded as sinful, always regarded as a serious crime. And here Augustine is commenting not on the question of someone who is intentionally inducing an abortion, but the moral legal question of someone who is guilty of violence, whether intentional or unintentional, against a pregnant woman, which has the result of that woman having a miscarriage. The question is, when does it become homicide? When is that person guilty of murder, even if the woman survives, because through this act of violence they have caused her to deliver the child prematurely? And Augustine, in light of what will become the Western tradition, is, and undoubtedly influenced, whether directly or indirectly, by Aristotle's reflections, convinced that there is a greater significance, a greater gravity to the crime later in gestation, although he does not say when that would be, but he does raise the question, the issue that was discussed in his day and would continue to be discussed during the Middle Ages, the question of the formed or unformed embryo or fetus, that there would be some point in gestation when the crime would be regarded as much graver. And here he's speaking of it as having to do with being endowed with senses. So again, just so we're aware of this passage, and very much aware that it is in no sense an encouragement for or even a hint at abortion being regarded as permissible in the writings of Augustine. So these theological reflections all have very great implications for the question of respect for and a willingness to defend human life from conception, even in circumstances where one would be tempted to try to hide from that reality. Again, the terrible moral issue of a child that can't be delivered alive, the temptation would be to say, well, the child's not really living, therefore it's not really murder to kill the child. The tradition will say, well, yes, it is, and one has to deal and grapple with that terrible question as well. Again, this is all by way of reminding ourselves that many of the issues that are absolutely pertinent and central to today's political and moral theological reflections on the beginning of life and its consequences for law and for human action, these questions have been pondered for centuries since very early times in the Christian tradition.